Innovation Rockstars.
Innovation Rockstars.
Today with John Miranda, Director of Strategy Office at the Data Center and AI Group at Intel.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Innovation Rockstars. My name is Chris Mühlroth, and in this episode, I am glad to welcome John Miranda, Director, Strategy Office, Data Center, and AI Group at Intel. He's responsible for a lot of things, including market and technology trend sensing, uncovering strategic opportunities and gaps, forming recommendations, and working with the executive leadership team at Intel to shape investment actions across Intel's data center and AI group. So John, thank you so much for your time. It is a real pleasure having you.
Thank you so much, Chris. Glad to be here.
All right, so let's kick things off, as always, with a short 60 seconds introduction sprint. So this is all about you, your career, and your role at Intel. So for the next 60 seconds, the virtual stage is all yours. Let's go.
All right, so dating back to high school, I cut my teeth programming, you know, Commodore PETs, Commodore 64s, Apple IIs. So I was quite the computer geek, maybe not the most popular kid in high school. But that led to getting a degree in computer science and another degree in business. I worked at Ford Motor Company for a while and then made my way to Intel. And I did application development at Intel. And then I led a team of application developers at Intel. But then I started getting really fascinated around thinking about the ecosystem in technology and where was it headed and what was Intel's role in all that. So I was able to get an opportunity in running Intel's corporate foresight program. And then I subsequently discovered that participating in strategy is also rewarding. So now I find myself in the data center and AI strategy office.
Okay, great. So next I do have three sentence starters for you. I would like you to complete them. So let's start with number one. I usually start my mornings with
coffee, toast, the news, and letting the dogs out to do their business.
Great start. All right. Number two, astro imaging is...
It's a perfect way to burn a lot of money and deprive yourself of sleep. So, I spent a few years programming the telescope and the camera, and you take a few hundred exposures in the middle of the night, and then the next day you're rewarded with all these files that you then, you know, try to extract the maximum signal from the noise. And so in some ways there's parallels to foresight program there. So I'm still a geek at times.
Great parallel. And by the way, I've seen some of these images and I can just say really impressive. And then finally, number three, I work at Intel because
the three things come to mind. The first is the opportunity to interact with really, really brilliant people, and which I really appreciate. I find myself in a role that's just nonstop learning. So that learning aspect is very rewarding for me personally. And the third piece is the opportunity to shape the company and shape the ecosystem and the industry is also exciting to me.
It's a great mindset to be in. Thanks. And John, as I learned, you do have a passion for travel and landscape photography and, of course, astro imaging as well. And by the way, I do recommend everyone to visit johnmiranda.com, especially the featured selection of images is really, really impressive. So, John, by the way, what's the next country that you will travel to?
You know, I've had a lot of false starts with COVID, right? I was supposed to go to Europe and then that got postponed, and I was supposed to go to Europe, then that got postponed, and I was going to go to Japan and that got canceled. Maybe it's a sign of the times to simplify a bit. So my family and I are moving to Central Coast, California. It's a beautiful area with beautiful mountains and scenery. And so maybe I'm going to travel one county over. In other words, ride my bicycle or drive a few minutes and enjoy some new park as opposed to constantly thinking about getting on a long-haul flight. But having said all that, I really appreciate and miss visiting Europe. So I don't know yet.
Sounds wonderful. And of course, Europe would be always happy to have you around. So, and now let's, you know, talk about a topic that has been, let's say, discussed controversially for quite a few years now, Moore's Law, right? So, and a brief recap maybe before that. So in, I guess, 1965, Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel, said that the number of transistors that can be packed into a given space, unit of space, will basically double about every 2 years. And but the thing is, you know, Moore did not call his observation a law himself, right? He just made that statement, which then eventually became a prediction and then kind of a rule, a law, if you wish. Yeah. So fast forward to today, I guess soon we will see 3 nanometers nodes being put into commercial production. And nanometer, that is incredibly small. I guess, you know, it is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter. And if I recall it correctly, Intel even forecasts 2 nanometers production by somewhat 2024 and 1.8 nanometers for, yeah, about 2025. But we've heard it many times in the past that Moore's law was always, you know, deemed to be dead, it's not valid anymore, and so on. So John, as transistors actually, you know, reach really atomic scale and manufacturing costs actually seem to go up again, will Moore's law be over soon, but this time for real?
Yeah, to your point, many predictions, even when transistors were 1,000 times larger than they are now, predictions were made that was the end of the line, right? And here we're demonstrating, and Intel's not unique, in a line of sight for maybe 5 to even 10 years of continued transistor shrinkage. But having said that, there are some challenges. The first was we hit kind of this thermal barrier at around 4 gigahertz around the year 2000. If you remember, it was a lot of fun in compute then, because your program always ran faster every 18 months or 2 years, right? And then we hit 4 gigahertz and things got too hot. So we had to make a turn, and the turn was multi-core. So we went from single-threaded, single-core performance to now you had 2 cores, 4 cores, 8 cores, which forced a change in programming models to become more parallelizable and exploit all these cores. But even then, we're going to start hitting in some limits around, you know, how many cores can you get on a die. So, but there's lots of pathways of innovation. So, for example, you can look at domain-specific architectures, GPUs, FPGAs, but even more specific, that are really tailored to specific workloads to get more performance. Looking farther out, you know, there's optical compute, which is still in research, but the promise is much higher orders of performance and energy savings. And for certain workloads, you have things like quantum computing that are farther out in the horizon. So and then finally, one last area of innovation is packaging. So combining different tiles, if you will, of compute optimized for different functions. So you can continue to get more compute in a smaller space for lower cost. So I think we still have, you know, a 10-year line of sight of seeing improvement. But it is getting harder.
It is, and but 10 years, you know, of course, is still a long time. Actually, when you think of in terms of the rapid technological advancement we've seen lately. But what about cloud computing? You just mentioned parallelization as well. I mean, is kind of Moore's law still, you know, determining a determining fact and factor in the area of cloud computing? Since, you know, the cloud just offers both vast and scalable resources on demand, actually, that enable a collection of computers to just deliver outstanding performance without actually having to have frequent hardware updates or upgrades. So is it still as relevant and important than maybe 5 or 10 years ago?
I think so, more than ever. I mean, the rate of data center build out is still, you know, moving very, very rapidly. And as the world becomes more digitized, developing countries, they're gonna need access to cloud compute. AI can consume enormous amounts of compute resources. And then don't forget the edge and a decentralized cloud. You know, your future autonomous car is a computer with 4 tires on it, and in its own right will be its own data center. If you look at smart factories and smart cities, the volume of data they're going to generate and velocity and variety is just going to be absolutely enormous, so much so that you won't be able to send it all to the cloud. You're going to have to do a lot of that computation closer to the edge. So they will become, if you will, kind of these decentralized data centers. So I see no slowdown in any of this at this time.
Got it. And let's stay for a moment with some of these future topics you already just briefly mentioned. As we all know, change is the only constant, right? So let's move to that. What are, in your opinion, you mentioned some of them already, but what are some of the most significant drivers of change, trends, and maybe even disruptors in the foreseeable future?
Yeah, so things that I think sustainability and the carbon climate crisis will be the number one most important thing that's going to affect us over the next several decades, and it's already starting to happen now. And that has implications for compute, which requires enormous energy to perform, but also there's opportunity that compute can play in that space. But other areas are, think about compute as having had three eras. So first era, we went to compute, to the keyboard, and then in the 2000s, we started wearing compute with our smartphones. And so now we're entering this third era where, compute kind of surrounds us. There's elements of metaverse that might play into that, where you start becoming immersed in that compute environment. So I think we're going to start seeing that transformation over the next few years. In terms of AI, generative AI and the progress that's happening in natural language processing, where compute is really getting close to being able to be your assistant author or read books and summarize them for you. So we're going to start seeing some dramatic change happening there, I believe, in the next few years. Digital personas, I think we're seeing a lot of geopolitical trends, populism. And then I think there's another trend that we need to think about, which is truth and the amplification of how viral messages can take off. And truth no longer belongs to the expert doctor. It belongs to whose, conspiracy tweet has more followers and goes viral. And so we're having debates that should be settled, but seemingly they keep popping up, at such a rapid rate. So just thinking about elements of trust and truth and how compute is amplifying some of the noise in that space, I think is something we need to think about.
Yeah, that's highly impactful. Truth not being based on facts anymore, but rather based on, the number of followers you have, and then just shouting out a message to the social channels is certainly a big problem. But let's go back to sustainability for a moment. Sure, it's a big one. I can imagine that Intel's manufacturing processes, for example, I could imagine they are probably, very resource intensive, right? Water and electricity and so on. So, what is Intel up to in terms of sustainability?
Yeah, so per our corporate sustainability report in 2020, we offset 81% of our global manufacturing with renewable investments. We reclaimed, and made large investments in water conservation and restoration. Sustainability includes things such as conflict-free mineral sourcing, and Intel played a leadership role there for many years. But one area that's really taking off is thinking about, beyond our operations, how are our products used in society? What is their impact in terms of kind of their embodied carbon, the carbon to make the chips, as well as their energy consumption, and thinking about principles of circular economy, how to keep these things operating longer, what's their end of life look like. So we're starting to think a lot more deeply and work with some of our largest customers around sustainability in the context after we sell the product, as well as our manufacturing operations.
Got it. So there is a lot of opportunity to uncover and also to kind of gain from. Okay. And now you mentioned also artificial intelligence, for sure, generative AI and natural language processing, digital personas and so on. Can you just, walk us briefly through those and explain, why they are deemed important? And also, it would be interesting to understand how is Intel actually using artificial intelligence to innovate?
Yeah, so, the area, like natural language processing is an interesting one for me, because if you look at recent progress, like in 2020 models, these mega models called GPT-3 and transformers and the like, they really are starting to make uncanny progress in terms of, generating text. You give it a couple paragraphs and it'll generate a couple more. And if you don't like it, you press a button, it'll generate five other versions. And they're all pretty readable. There's still work to do, but language, natural language, is the basis of human interaction. It's the basis of business. And when these technologies start hitting a tipping point where computers can start interacting in our language, I think there's going to be a profound effect. Within Intel, you know, if I take the term AI, the current renaissance of it is really statistical machine learning, when you think about it. And statistical machine learning has been used for over, you know, well over a decade in our fabs for yield analysis. When you have two wafers and one is slightly yielding better than the other, and in its journey, you accumulate over a million variables in its multi-month journey from beginning to end. And now if you have no idea where why one is a little bit better than the other, you're applying at scale statistical machine learning to try to uncover what's that subtlety on one that didn't affect the other. And when you have multi-billion dollar factories, even, you know, 1% yield difference is worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars for any mega fab. And then beyond manufacturing, sales and marketing, using machine learning to study, you know, patterns in customer sentiment. For my research in insights, you know, we use NLP tools, you know, as part of our practice to you know, scan a billion articles and uncover patterns and clusters and so on. So it's becoming ingrained, like in many aspects of what we do day in and day out. And I think it's probably true for many large corporations, not just Intel.
So would you say it's, you know, this technology is already kind of intelligent, or is it mainly, as you said, basically just, you know, statistical machine learning, supervised, unsupervised, doesn't matter, but the real intelligence is still missing today?
Yeah, it's definitely missing. Yeah, this is all statistical. You know, you give it a bazillion data points and it can do some interesting things, but it's still weak in terms of reasoning by analogy. You know, these kind of things that humans do so naturally, you know, and that's probably, you know, let's say the third wave of AI. We started with expert systems and they were brittle, but they were logic based and explainable. And then we more recently entered the statistical machine learning era, which does some amazing stuff, but can't explain anything. Like, did it classify the picture of a cat as a dog? You don't know, right? You can't, it's very hard to diagnose it. So it's not explainable. It can't adapt that reasoning and generalize to other areas. And I think that's where AI, you know, the next challenge for AI will be, is to tackle those types of problems.
Which I guess oftentimes also is kind of, you know, packaged into the term explainable AI, right? So just make sure researchers and maybe practitioners actually understand what's happening inside the black box input, then some crazy AI stuff and then output. But, you know, if you would basically apply it for maybe even supporting just decision making, obviously it would be interesting to understand how it actually came to its conclusion, what data points it actually, you know, basically changed, how the neural net maybe worked in between. So there is a lot of research still to be done. I guess that's totally true. And you also mentioned the metaverse, now rushing through all these topics, right? But, you know, what's kind of Intel's stake in the metaverse? So I do understand, of course, you know, Facebook, that now rebranded as Meta, just recently. I do understand, of course, NVIDIA maybe, you know, representing a key stake with all the GPUs and graphical units that are kind of required. So what's it with Intel? I mean, is it like represented in the metaverse, as some brands like Adidas, Nike already are doing, kind of building a truth inside the metaverse and the brand inside there? Or is it rather, you know, a key enabler for it, or maybe even both? What's your take on this?
By tradition, Intel is generally an enabler by providing the compute to support it, and it will require enormous compute, graphics, networking, and data center. In my role, one area I've been more thinking about is more the kind of the societal aspect, and really thinking about the question, especially in this post-COVID era, transmission of presence. What does it mean to be somewhere? What does it mean not to be somewhere? When do you get on a plane, or will get on a plane for a meeting, and when do you use this format? And even, you know, when you think about the limitations of Zoom and WebEx and all these tools that have been wonderful in this era, there's still so much more room to go. Like in 2022, we shouldn't be asking, hey, can you see my presentation, right? Like if you had a whiteboard and you were to design a collaborative system for Itonix employees that are in multiple continents, how would you design it? and it probably wouldn't be the way it is today. But I think concepts around more immersive experiences where the audio is coming from the right direction, so it draws you into the meeting, I think will be an interesting space to watch in terms of kind of the future of work. You know, within Intel, we're starting to internalize what does those engagements with compute in this way mean, and what role do we play? Do we want to play an enabler role, or do we want to play a richer role? I think there's still some questions there, but I do think it will be, you know, a transformative experience. And there's some people that are, have some concerns around that too. Like, are we going to just sit around in a basement and put a face mask and pretend we're in Bora Bora and escape daily life? I don't know. But it is interesting to see how it's evolving.
But isn't that the case for all kind of emerging and new technologies? So probably at least disruptive technologies. I mean, there is dystopian, then there is utopian scenarios about that. And then ultimately, you know, just following the plane hype cycle, right? And maybe even in 5 or 10 years, we will, you know, have reached a plateau of productivity, and then we can really tell. But of course, change always comes with uncertainty, with opportunity. So I guess it's just normal for the metaverse also to explore these kind of scenarios in the future, right?
It is. And maybe if I could just add one more thing. You know, a few years ago, I was at Institute for the Future, and it was really an interesting experience. They, in their multimedia lab, I put on these headsets, and I found myself in an alleyway in China. And in this part of China, these alleyways, they're always painting these paintings that wind up in hotels around the world, right? And I'm there, and and as you look, the audio is coming from the right place, and people are looking at me, and I can hop around and move. And then a character pops in my field of view, and he says, "Hey, John, follow me. I want to show you around." And he was calling from Nairobi, Africa. And I was in Palo Alto, California. But mentally, we were in China. Like, I was so immersed. If the building was on fire, I'm not sure I would have left, right? We had a different reality than the people surrounding us. And it was compelling. I was thinking, what would it be like to have breakfast with my cousins in Europe that I haven't seen a couple of years in a cafe in Paris, you know, without getting on the plane? Of course, it'd be better to get on the plane and be there, of course, but sometimes we can't travel for different reasons. What would that be like, you know? So it's something, it was definitely a thought-provoking experience.
Definitely. And with all these thought experiments and also the ideas, ultimately, you know, this is bringing us back to change. And what we've seen with change and also with large corporations in the past is far too often large companies actually fail to identify and respond timely to emerging change. That could be the metaverse, but that could be anything that is deemed to be disruptive or at least revolutionary, right? And this all happens despite an abundance of resources and employees with extensive knowledge, extensive capabilities, and maybe even a lot of budget. So, you know, John, why do you think this still keeps happening? Why do still large organizations oftentimes fail to identify things early and then also act upon that?
Yeah, and I think that's a multi-decade question now, like Christensen's dilemma, or the notion that a company was very successful in growing a franchise or a business, and then there's resistance to adapting as the market is evolving in a new direction. The forces, if you will, that have influence in a company tend to be the ones that are leading the largest business units that are the ones generating the profits and paying all our paychecks. So now all of a sudden, you know, some insight group comes in, a foresight group, hey, the market's moving here and there's this huge opportunity, and if you don't get it, you know, you're going to miss out and it's not going to play out well. But the thing is, you know, I've come to appreciate as well is the perspective of an executive. They're getting a pitch, you know, every day from some part of the company, from someone that says, hey, this trend is happening. If you don't act now, it's going to be the doom and gloom, right? Like your whole business is going to implode. And it starts becoming a cacophony of noise from their lens, right? If you're confronted with this idea every single day at the end of the month, you can't keep reacting to everything. And then that gets into a challenge of how do you separate the signal from that noise? And what are the few most important things to index on? And then you still have the daily pressure. You got to go meet with your current customer who may be pushing you and applying a lot of pressure and your stockholders and investors that keep pulling you back into to the core business. I think those are some elements that I think make it challenging for companies to navigate and reinvent themselves. It's hard, and I think, you know, the history has shown many examples from Kodak to Nokia to many others that fail to embrace the change.
And I guess it is precisely for those reasons, right, that Intel has a corporate foresight program these days, including TrendScape as a kind of a global early warning system for emerging signals and trends. But still, it's about, you know, cutting noise from the signals. So can you walk me through kind of the key elements of your corporate foresight program?
Yeah. So one key element is that we're a community of contributors. That's just how we architected it. So it's not a small ivory office of super smart people locked away reading all day long, but it's a contributor network of individuals from different parts of the company. Some are technical, some are thinking about policy and legal, others are thinking about societal implications and ethics. And so that breadth of thinking is very important. And we come together, you know, a couple times a quarter and really start exchanging perspectives on what we're seeing. And then, you know, we go through a more formalized review that critiques, you know, the topics that we're raising and the points of view that we're raising and why we think they're important. So we go through that process, you know, a few times a year to be a kind of evergreen. And then on top of that, other elements is, you know, we use Itonix as a tool and other tools to validate our hypothesis. If we think something is taking off, then we can engage different resources, primary, secondary research, validate, is this really happening, and test certain hypotheses. If we think this is true, what else must be true? And can we test that other thing really to kind of help validate? And then finally, the third element is, you know, partnering with executives, having those relationships and other stakeholder teams across the company, like the broader corporate strategy office that I partner with and others, you know, to drive change. Because at the end of the day, insights without change is not enough. We really have to drive change.
Ultimately, so we have sensing, right? We have interpreting and then kind of acting upon the insights gained. And when, you know, when talking to a lot of companies in the recent months and also years, it became kind of clear that it's not always easy, let's say, to start the engagement, especially if you want to kind of have a cross-company engagement, right? So how did you get started? How did you actually start to engage practitioners across the company? And how do you also keep up the engagement rate over a long time?
Yeah, you know, the start was really a group of us had a network because we came from different experiences at Intel. And you know, that we were aware of, you start, it's funny, it's even in a company as big as Intel, there's over 100,000 of us, you start really identifying the community who's really thought leaders, who are intellectually inquisitive, always reading, always testing ideas, coming up with novel thinking, and you start discovering each other through networking, or you meet with one and they'll say, you know, you should talk up to this person. Like, if you want to understand cybersecurity, this is the person you need to go talk to. And then you talk to them and you build it out. And I think one area of managing a community is thinking about what do they want to get out of a foresight program and you know, giving value back to them. Like, if you just take their insights and run away with it, you'll probably see it atrophy. But, you know, when I come across a topic from one side of the company that I know someone in another side of the company is deeply interested in, but they probably don't know this other person, I will connect them. Or if I come across a resource, an external resource, a conference, a speaker that I have a membership to that they don't have a membership to, I will reach out and say, hey, there's this global thought leader who's going to talk on this subject. I have an extra seat that I can give you because I think you would be very interested in this topic. So making those deposits to the contributors that are part of your network, I think helps, is a very key element to maintain their interest and engagement.
Yeah, because ultimately, you know, this lives by the practitioners, by the ones that are constantly providing input. And as you said, like networking and connecting, so actually be the central hub and then reaching out to the other individuals and practitioners, providing high value and information to them. And then, of course, asking, hey, can I contribute too? Certainly seems to be the key. Now, that's for sensing, right? And for engaging them and maybe also for interpreting. Okay, understood. Now, activating those insights for sure is the other part of it, right? So really execution. So how do you kind of activate foresight and the insights gained in a large enterprise such as Intel?
And arguably, and even talking to colleague and fellow travelers outside of Intel, this can be the most, you know, interesting and complex area to navigate. You know, we're all more or less seeing the same trends. Some people are a little bit ahead of others and have some unique insight, but the activating part, especially in large, complex, you know, environments, is one that requires a lot of thought. I think, you know, with respect to, you know, you need to identify the stakeholder that's the decision maker that you're trying to influence, because it can vary depending on the topic you're raising. And then understand what's your influence level with that stakeholder. Do they know you? Do they trust you? What's the depth of that relationship? Are you a trusted advisor, or is it just a name they kind of know you, but nah, you know? And if you don't have that strength of relationship, can you make deposits to build it? And if you don't have that, do you know who their trusted advisors are? And do you have deposits with them, or can you make deposits with them that invite them to bring you by proxy? Like, we can, hey, you should hear what this person has to say. And then when you're not seeking them to make a decision that you're trying to drive, back to always make deposits. Think about, you know, executives typically, their day is littered with people asking something of them all day long. You know, they're in 12 calls. I need money. I need resources. I need heads. I need political air cover. I need permission to do something, right? You'll be unique if you're the only meeting that they have that day where, hey, I am coming here to offer you something that I think you will value. And you start building that deposit, right? So down the road, when you're trying to influence them in a certain way, you'll have a more open door to do that. So always thinking about how can you build that relationship, and not with the mindset that you're always there to take, in the sense of, I just want them to decide and align to what I think. But you haven't really done the work to build that credibility in that relationship. I think that's incredibly important.
Yeah. And I think this is not only true for business context, right? But actually for life. Yeah? So give, and then maybe, you know, not only take, which is kind of, you could maybe summarize as that. But that's a great philosophy and a great mindset to be in. You know, that's clearly the do's. So what about the don'ts? What should you not do, basically, when trying to activate foresight in a large enterprise? What are some of the pitfalls that you can share?
Losing trust. So it takes a long time to acquire trust, but you can lose trust awfully fast. So if someone shares some sensitive content and you don't preserve it in the way they would like to see, if you put someone in a bad light or in a bad situation, intentionally or unintentionally, you can quickly lose trust, right? And then say do. If you say you're going to do something, do it, no matter how small. Follow through with it. Sometimes I've been in this situation, and others are in the situation where you're getting to know someone. You might have a simple ask, and if you have to remind them a week later or two because it hasn't been fulfilled, they're already losing credibility. Like, if they can't even do the simple thing, why am I going to trust them with counseling my business? So, you know, follow through and consistency are ways to build trust.
And I guess these are actually all great leadership lessons, right?
So
thanks for sharing.
Yeah,
in general, absolutely. I totally agree. You know, some time ago, I read the book High Output Management by Andrew Grove, the former chairman of and CEO of Intel. And impressive book. And besides many other things, my attention was drawn to the concept of managerial leverage, right? A classic in that book. And You know, in short, managers should aim for as many high impact and positive effect activities as possible. So high impact activities, you know, for example, affect many people, do have a long effect, change collective ways of working for humans, and so on. And positive effect, yeah, that should be clear. But there, you know, negative effect activities could include, you know, being indecisive as a leader, or, you know, simply lack of preparation as a key participant in important meetings, thus wasting other people's time. So always aim for high impact and positive effect activities. Now, John, my question to you would be, to what extent is the corporate foresight program at Intel actually a high impact and positive effect program?
Yeah, so on the first, I think of the program as more, you know, is it shaping the course of the company? So, you know, like in one topic that we've been raising, we organize an internal call. I participated in with three other colleagues, and we had 1,700 employees dial in live on that call. So it shows that you're starting to really effect change in culture in the company on a particular topic that Trendscape raised. On the second, I view it as more of an individual thing and role modeling. You know, culture that Andy Grove and Gordon Moore set in the company when they were founding it. I was just, you know, not too far out of school, but I was lucky enough to have just really a couple, you know, quick interactions with Andy Grove and Gordon Moore. And it was fascinating. And at the time, I used to fly from Phoenix to San Jose Airport on America West was the airline, and about a quarter of that plane was Intel employees on any given morning, right? And you would see Andy Grove walking onto the plane and walking back to coach, and then Gordon Moore as almost a billionaire by then. You know, they were role modeling that they were in it with the employees, and I know some employees that were embarrassed because their upgrade cleared and they're in first class and they're watching Gordon Moore walk past them. And then when we landed, and these are real experiences, right? I would see the two of them waiting at the Hertz line to get their subcompact car, and then they're just driving down the road to the campus. No chauffeur, none of these private jets and all these accoutrements.
Oh, helicopters.
Yeah. And they built this company with that culture and that role modeling. But Andy Grove was famous for, if you had a simple action required from a call, 24 hours later, if it was something that should be closed, like send me this document or something, he would chase the person down a day later, like, why, it's been 24 hours, why haven't you closed it? What are you waiting for? There was one instance where, anyways, I could go on and on and on, but I think they set a great culture, and our new CEO, Pat Gelsinger, who returned to Intel this year, is really doing an amazing job of bringing that culture back, because when Pat was younger in his career, Andy Grove was his mentor, and it shaped his thinking as an executive. And so it's great to see Pat coming back and bringing some of those principles and reemphasizing them to the way that they were earlier in the company's existence.
That's really exciting and great stories. Thanks for sharing, John. And we covered a lot in this episode. We rushed through so many topics on emerging technologies and the future and dystopian and utopian and what have not. Yeah, but we're already nearing the end of this episode. But before we leave, two more questions. Number one, you know, what is next for you and also for Intel's corporate foresight program? What's the future of it?
You know, for me, I'm having about as much fun as I think I've ever had in my career. I feel very fortunate in this space. And what I like about it, and I mentioned it in the beginning, was just the rate of learning and interacting with just really amazing people. And as long as I have the opportunity to continue doing that, I would enjoy continuing to do what I'm doing today, you know, running a foresight program, sitting in the strategy office and helping shape the company's direction in my own way as best as I can. So for now, I'm pretty content. As for the corporate foresight program, it's thinking about how do we take it to the next level? How do we engage more richly at even more senior levels? It's continuous improvement. It's adopting new tools and methods, and you know that are emerging to help better shape our thinking. But the learning never ends, and that's what makes it fun.
It does. Great. And always be kind of at the edge or on the edge of what's possible. Great to hear. So, you know, complementary to foresight, now the hindsight. Yeah. So looking back at your career at Intel, and I need to ask the question for sure, you know, what was your greatest innovation rock star moment so far?
I think driving the sustainability topic from a product perspective was probably my biggest breakthrough. In terms of, you know, Intel for many years has thought about sustainability in the context of manufacturing. We have, you know, environmental experts, and we have to comply with, you know, regulatory, and we're trying to, you know, set a leadership position in how we run our fabs. But it was more nascent thinking about it from a product team perspective. And Intel has a process where if you have a certain topic you want to surface, you go through these series of here test it a few times, but if you get it completed all the way through, you get the CEO in the top 100 for 45 minutes. And so I managed to clear those hurdles and landed that presentation last summer with the company's global executive staff, and really, you know, talking about how sustainability is going to become more and more important in the ecosystem we're a part of from our product portfolio perspective. And since then, I'm just seeing, you know, enormous engagement, and you know I'm interacting with members of the CEO staff on this topic, and that has been a really great breakthrough, very rewarding, and it's an important topic. But it makes me wonder, like, okay, so you took this topic that, you know, a few people were talking about in a product context, and now we have hundreds, if not over 1,000, talking about this topic. But so now in 2022, what's that next thing that maybe only a few, you know, half a dozen people are kind of starting to think about that maybe 3 years hence, 500 people should be talking about? And I don't know what that thing is, but if you have any ideas, Chris, let me know. But it's something I'm also starting to percolate, like what's behind that?
Yeah, great. And so this makes up for a fantastic innovation rockstar moment. And for sure, we can, you know, have a candid discussion on, you know, what's maybe next. I would love to hear your opinion on this, and maybe I also share some of my ideas. But for now, really, John, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for, again, you know, for all these insights, for the inspiring exchange, and also the aspects that we were able to spotlight together. So yeah, thanks for taking the time. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Chris. As always, a pleasure. Really enjoyed our conversation today. It was very thought-provoking. Thank you.
Awesome. And to everybody listening or watching, if you want to learn more about this story or get in touch, then simply leave us a comment on this episode or just drop us an email at info@innovationrockstars.show. Now, that's it. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. And Innovation, see you in the next episode. Rockstars. Take care and bye-bye.
That was innovation rockstar John Miranda on Corporate Foresight at Intel. If you want to dive deeper into the topic, or if you'd simply like to give us feedback on this episode or suggest someone that you think would be a great innovation rockstar, feel free to email us at info@innovationrockstars.show. For more inspiring innovation stories, visit our website at www.innovationrockstars.show. Or browse through our Innovation Rockstars channel on all major podcast platforms.